To a Frenchman, the aspect of the city is bizarre and not very agreeable, he wrote to his mother. One sees neither dome nor bell tower nor great edifice, with the result that one has the constant impression of being in a suburb. In its center, the city is built of brick, which gives it a most monotonous appearance. Welcome to 10 Minute Mitzvah, episode 167, Tocqueville's Cities and Towns. I'm Meir Soloveitchik.
Rabbi Soloveitchik's year-long 10-Minute Mitzvah podcast is generously sponsored by Ivan and Susanna Kaufman.
When Alexis de Tocqueville, the brilliant French aristocrat, visited the United States in the first half of the 19th century, a tour that inspired his great work, Democracy in America, he visited both American cities and its smaller towns, and he came away decidedly in favor of the towns. This is described in an article in 1993 in City Journal by Witold Rybczynski, titled Alexis de Tocqueville, Urban Critic. We are told in this article that, quote, "It is Tocqueville's letters and the 14 notebooks that he kept during his travels, more than his famous book, that are the best source for his opinions about American cities and towns. In general, he was impressed by small towns. While traveling through Massachusetts, he recorded, almost all the houses are charming, especially in the villages, and there prevails a height of cleanliness, which is something astonishing." It was not only the architecture that impressed him. Tocqueville considered the New England town an exemplary democratic institution, since it involved a large number of citizens in managing their own affairs. He called the town the ultimate individual in the American system. He was also astute enough to observe that the political independence of these small communities lay in what he called their municipal spirit. "Americans love their towns," he wrote, "for much the same reasons that Highlanders love their mountains. In both cases, the native land has emphatic and peculiar features. It has more pronounced physiognomy than is found elsewhere." Here, more than a century before Capra's It's a Wonderful Life, is clear evidence of the widely held American affection for the small town. End quote. So the article describes. Then we are further told, Tocqueville visited what is, for many of us, the ultimate embodiment of the large city. We are further informed in Rybczynski's article about Tocqueville's travels with his friend Gustave de Beaumont. Quote, "Tocqueville spent a total of 2 months in New York, since it was the base from which he and Beaumont set out on their several trips. But he never warmed to the city. In a letter to his friend, Ernest de Chabrol, he described the island side of New York as admirable, but complained about the lack of noteworthy public monuments, and added that it does not resemble in the least our principal cities in Europe. To a Frenchman, the aspect of the city is bizarre and not very agreeable, he wrote to his mother. One sees neither dome nor bell tower nor great edifice, with the result that one has the constant impression of being in a suburb. In its center, the city is built of brick, which gives it a most monotonous appearance. The houses have neither cornices nor balustrades nor porte cochere. The only good thing he found to say about New York was that although the streets were badly paved, all had sidewalks." End quote. Of course, New York then was not like New York now, and Tocqueville might have been struck by how the city has changed when it came to his own reference to impressive edifices. Be that as it may, to read Tocqueville, or to read a description of his diaries, is to be struck by how impressed he is by the American love of both towns and rural life. But we also understand the vision of an American founder like Alexander Hamilton, who, living in New York, understood the importance of the city to America's future. In truth, both town and city can be of great importance to the formation of a country. And it is with this perspective that we consider a law that is introduced in Leviticus as an exception to the Jubilee. As we have previously seen, every 50 years, ancestral land reverts to the family who had that land as a heritage. This is the assertion of the verse, which states regarding the Jubilee, or in Hebrew the Ovel, Vishavtem ish el achuzato, each man shall return to his heritage. But in a separate mitzvah, Leviticus emphasizes an exception. When what is purchased is not land, but rather a house in a walled city, then the owner of this house has 1 year to buy the home back from the purchaser. After that, it stays with the new buyer in perpetuity, unless that buyer chooses to sell it to another. This is Leviticus 25, verse 29, Sepharia translation. If any party sells a dwelling house in a walled city, it may be redeemed until a year has elapsed since its sale. The redemption period shall be a year. If it is not redeemed before a full year has elapsed, a house in the walled city shall pass to the purchaser beyond reclaim throughout the ages. It shall not be released in the Jubilee. But houses in villages that have no encircling walls should be classed as open country. They may be redeemed and they shall be released through the Jubilee. In other words, homes in unwalled towns are considered akin to land, but not houses in walled cities. Why the difference? Rabbi Yoel Elitzur explained that towns without walls are considered more rural. They are essentially extensions of the land. As such, they are bound up with the heritage that is returned in Jubilee, that reverts to the original familial owner. In contrast, what the Bible terms an ir choma, a city with a wall, is an urban area. It has a different status entirely. What we see, in other words, is that the Bible seeks to ensure that the rural areas retain their familial inhabitants based on the original apportionment of the land to the tribes. Cities, in contrast, have a bit of ferment and change that the rural area might not necessarily have. And both, it seems, are important. Each respective character is maintained. The article in City Journal concludes by reflecting that, quote, there was another American city, however, that might have elicited a more favorable opinion, Washington. After all, it was planned by Tocqueville's countryman, Pierre Charles L'Enfant, and was intended to be a leading example of civic beauty. And then he adds a bit later that, quote, when Tocqueville and Beaumont visited Washington, they spent about 2 weeks meeting public officials and consulting government archives. The city was 40 years old, but lacking a good port and commerce. It was growing slowly and held only about 20,000 people. Since there was no indication in L'Enfant's plan of how the city might expand in phases, construction was taking place in a scattershot fashion, with groups of houses here and there. It gave the impression, according to Tocqueville, of a town composed of 5 or 6 villages. Compared to the carefully drafted plans made first by L'Enfant and later by the surveyor Andrew Ellicott, the reality was almost comical. The mile-long mall was used as a cow pasture. The Ron's points scattered throughout the city, which were to commemorate the States of the Union, were planted with vegetables. The monumental avenues, 130 to 160 feet wide, that L'Enfant had created to link important sites were there all right, but they were flanked not by buildings, but by virgin forest or raw earth. The White House and the Capitol stood in forlorn splendor. There is disbelief in Tocqueville's voice when he notes that they have already rooted up trees for 10 miles around, lest they should get in the way of the future citizens of this imagined capital. In fact, the imagined capital will be splendidly realized, thanks to the 1901 Macmillan Commission, and the future citizens of Washington would spread out far beyond 10 miles around. But that was in a future that even the Prussian Frenchmen could not foresee. End quote. We never know, in other words, what the future might hold. And this is true in a much more miraculous way when we ponder the fact that thousands of years after the laws of cities and towns were given by divine revelation in the Bible, we see both land and cities restored in the reborn Jewish state. Both revitalized land, as well as the revitalized towns and the cities, are essential to Israel's future. And though the 12 tribes are not all returned to their lands, we can feel gratitude for the miracles that we have seen and allow these laws to inspire us to gratitude. This is Meir Soloveitchik, looking forward to learning together tomorrow. Signing off.